This is audiobook of Stranger at the Pentagon by Frankie Stranges. First printing 1967. Dr. Frankie Stranges is founder, president of the National Investigations Committee on UFOs. In addition, he is president of International Evangelism Crusades, a worldwide Christian denomination, and International Theological Seminary of California. He was born in New York and educated in Brooklyn, Pennsylvania, Minnesota and California. He holds degrees in theology, psychology and criminology. During the past 44 years, he has investigated various facets of the UFO phenomena and has authored many books on the subject. His interest began while he was attending Bible college after hearing his roommate tell of an experience during the war. He was told that the squadron in which his roommate was flying was buzzed by several UFOs, and during the debriefing, the pilots were told they had seen nothing unusual. After confirming the story personally with the other members of the flight team, Dr. Stranges began serious inquiry into the fascinating subject of UFOs. Dr. Stranges is an assistant deputy director of the California State Marshals Association and a chaplain of the American Federation of Police. Numerous affiliations with law enforcement, scientific, religious and public service organizations attest to his dedication to community service. His university and college presentations are recognized as an important contribution to the understanding of the truth about the UFO phenomena today. Foreword by Harley Andrew Bird. Project Blue Book. During the winter of 1956-57, the Washington, D.C. area was extremely cold, but it was a good feeling to be working in a high-security position in the Pentagon. I lived only a short distance away in Georgetown, the old section of the nation's capital. Senator J.F. Kennedy lived on O Street just a block away, Horner House on Prospect. During a successful tour of the U.S. Naval Ceremonial Honor Guard, we had met with astronauts Glenn, Cooper, Wally Schirra, who were the first wave of successful space travelers. Also, we had visited the Tomb of the Unknown Soldier numerous times. It seemed like every time a visiting dignitary came to Washington, they lay a wreath at the tomb. We had met the Queen of England several times at the airport, as these were some of the duties I performed as a young officer in the Navy. After carrying the two-star flag at the funeral of my late uncle, Rear Admiral Richard E. Byrd, I was recommended for a security clearance and was granted a top-secret clearance after a lengthy 6-month background study, BL Complete 1957. After being transferred to the Chief of Naval Information, CHINFO, I worked in the security clearance section before being indoctrinated into the branch office of the Air Force called Project Blue Book. It was a joint service office, that is, 2 Marines, 2 Army, 2 Navy and 3 Air Force officers. The work was routine, opening incoming mail, sorting out what was called actual sightings as opposed to many fake UFO photos. We also acted as a public information office, PIO, much like a public relations office. Every publisher's dream was to get the real lowdown on the UFO situation, which was suppressed by the group that dictated national policy on the UFO matter. In mid-March 1957, we received an urgent message from the Alexandria Police Department. The message indicated that 2 of their on-duty police officers had picked up an alien who had landed some 14 miles south of Pentagon Boulevard, and the occupant was transported to the Pentagon to meet with the Undersecretary of Defense and then shuttled underground to meet with President Eisenhower and Vice President Richard Nixon. The meeting lasted for nearly an hour, and then the alien visitor was put on VIP status and was shuttled back to the Pentagon, where he spent the night in the Army reception office on the first floor near the concourse. This alien's name was Valiant Thor. Commander James was on duty at the security clearance and review for the branch officer of the Project Blue Book. He oversaw the meeting through official channels and reported the landing and meeting of the space emissary, as he was labeled by the Department of Defense, to a governing group of high military officials including Secretary of Defense D.F. Forstall and other scientific men, of which there were 12. They in turn made recommendations to the president and cabinet members, the CIA, FBI, NSA and so on. The landing of Valiant Thor was perhaps the first documented landing of a human-type alien by military officials. He contacted an individual in the Pentagon who was an 14 advocate of the UFO alien situation. Nancy Warren in turn contacted a minister, who was also a private investigator and theologian, a Dr. Frank E. Stranges, who then met with this individual. Dr. Stranges had been a guest speaker at the National Evangelistic Center for 2 weeks. Val Thor landed in Alexandria and met with the president to discuss the world's problems and offer advice and counsel on how to deal with and eliminate them. He indicated to Mr. Eisenhower that the world was in a precarious situation and that if the world continued to proceed on a war footing which Val Thor felt would be a self-destruct mode, it would cause an economic imbalance throughout the world. Val Thor stayed on Earth until March 16, 1960, and then disembarked to his home planet Venus. He indicated that his race of people lived and dwelled underground and that many of the planets throughout the universe sustain life in this same manner. He also mentioned the waves of aliens who would land around the world to help with the Earth's seemingly insurmountable problems. He stated that a group from a distant planetary system would be coming to give aid and data to help the Earth's progress. Val Thor spoke of Christ's presence in the universe and that it was heartwarming to see Christ's advanced teaching continuing. This visitation at the Pentagon marks perhaps a new era in knowledge, wisdom and understanding on our planet. Introduction. It was while I was attending seminary school that I first heard about what were then being called flying saucers, and while others around me might have laughed, I felt I had an open mind and sincerely wanted to learn the truth. What I found was that astute men of authority had gone on record as being among those in the world that have admitted the presence and reality of the unidentified flying objects. Men such as Captain Eddie Rickenbacker, who said flying saucers are real. Too many good men have seen them, men that do not have hallucinations. Henry J. Taylor asserts that during his research to determine whether flying saucers actually do exist, and if so, where they have come from, I was actually stumped by the conflicting reports of eyewitnesses, until I found there are two mysteries in our skies instead of one. One mystery involves our development of secret weapons, but the other is not revealed by an earthly interpretation. Air Chief Marshal Lord Dowding, Command-in-Chief of the Royal Air Force, stated, "I am convinced that these objects do exist. They are not manufactured by any nation of this earth." The United States Air Force to this date has denied the very existence of flying saucers. Therefore, the term unidentified flying objects has been introduced and carried through. They evidently are not too certain as to the whys and wherefores. Or do they? The late Major Donald Kehoe, the renowned director of the National Investigations Committee on Aerial Phenomena, made a thorough investigation of this subject. Major Kehoe, as a result of his investigation, offered much information. He stated that flying discs actually change colors in the sky, and it has been proven. To affirm this, he states, during daytime periods, scores of metallic-looking discs have been seen to change color during maneuvers. One typical report, in 1950, described an encounter near Lewisburg, West Virginia. Two round, silvery discs had approached the city, then swung into a tight, fast circle. As the maneuvers began, both turned orange-red. When they straightened, reducing speed, the orange quickly faded and the discs resumed their normal silvery color. Also, be informed of the following event involving Captain Robert Addix, a stocky ex-Navy pilot with 10 years' service with the TWA. I refer to the dramatic incident near South Bend, Indiana. On the night of April 27, 1950 at 8:25 p.m., with Captain Addix in the left-hand seat of a TWA DC-3, over on the right, sat Robert F. Manning, also a four-stripe captain, who was acting as first officer on this flight to Chicago. The DC-3, Flight 117, was cruising at 20,000 feet when a strange, red light below and behind the airliner suddenly caught Manning's eye. Puzzled, Manning watched it close in the light steadily growing in size. It was now an orange-red color, a blob of hot metal sweeping through the night sky. Craning his neck, Manning looked down on a spherical shape which glowed brightly on top, its lower half in shadow. To Addix it looked like a huge red wheel rolling down a road. He banked toward it, but the discs instantly slid away, keeping the same distance. Again he tried, with the same results. Calling the hostess, Gloria Hinshaw, Addix told her to alert the passengers, to make sure he had plenty of witnesses. 18. A report on the type of men the pilots were from the TWA offices, described them both as quiet, conservative, serious, careful. Nobody in TWA questioned that Addix and Manning had seen exactly what they had said. Gloria Hinshaw had seen the disc from the cabin, and the pilotess cockpit. She told Major Kehoe, it looked like a big red wheel rolling along. She also made the statement that on top it looked like it was on fire. Major Kehoe interviewed all 11 passengers by long-distance calls. The first one being S.N. Miller, manager of a jewelry company in St. Paul. He had watched the saucer for several minutes. He accounted for it, saying, the thing was the color of a neon sign, not just a big red disc. I used to laugh at saucer stories, but not anymore. Major Kehoe said that among other passengers who confirmed the sighting, were C.H. Jenkins, and D.C. Bland, engineers with the Boeing Aircraft Co., and E.J. Fitzgerald, VP of a metal equipment corporation in Chicago. Later several officials of the International Harvester Company also admitted they had seen the glowing disc as it paced the plane. More reports of their fiery red appearance come from Greenville, S.C., where on the night of May 13, 1952, astronomers had seen four saucers flying glowing a reddish-yellow, amber. On June 19, 1952, intelligence reports came from Goose Bay Air Force Base that a glowing red disc approached the field at night. There is absolutely no question whatever concerning the actual existence of these flying objects. There is certainly something in the skies above us, and someone is responsible for them being there. It has been stated time and again that these objects must be under intelligent control. One of the greatest thorns in the flesh to many Bible scholars, ministers, etc., is the statement of life on other planets. It seems very strange that we who are finite beings continually attempt to force God into the test tube of our 2x4 human understanding and reasoning. We must never lose sight of the one prime fact that God is the Creator while we are His creation. During the past few years, I have met men and women from all walks of life. Many of these people are continually looking for truth. Seeking for the very truths that will cause a better way of life to come up over the far horizon. Nevertheless, if we can but place our trust in God, and lay hold on the blessings and provisions that are made for us through the Lord Jesus Christ, we might make the discovery that these great revelations are with the grasp of every honest believer. In the following pages, as you carefully study the questions and answers supplied me by this friend from outer space, you will find that unlike many other contact stories, Val does not minimize the fact that Jesus Christ is the first and the last, the Alpha and the Omega, and the beginning and the end. That is one great reason why I believe that Val has spoken the truth and nothing but the truth concerning his mission to this wayward planet. Often, events transpire that cause one to wonder if these 20 certain events really happened or are figments of the imagination. Then, one begins to ponder the facts that have caused an experience to really live. Writing this book has presented quite a challenge. The following is an account as told to me and which involved the Earth visits of one, Valiant Thor, from another planet. The story itself is quite unique. Many have read of this unusual visit at the Pentagon and have likewise claimed to have first-hand information that this event did in fact take place. At the same time, There are those who choose to accept this account as something that could not possibly have taken place because of the intense security at the Pentagon. Then again, there are those who would retort that the Pentagon is the only place this could have happened. It will be most interesting to continue watching this account develop over the coming years. Although these incidents took place beginning in 1957, they have reportedly been witnessed by many others in many parts of the world. Some of these witnesses have related the incidents while others have chosen to remain silent because of the fear of ridicule. They would never think of openly repeating their own experiences with one claiming to be from another world. Valiant addressed a special group of representatives at the United Nations in a closed session. The ramifications of such a gathering forced the exclusion of the media from this meeting. He appeared of his own free will. The delegates were stunned, some to the point of anger, some to the point of fear. He is on a special mission to this third planet from there. 21. Sunand is presently working with many hundreds of his crew in conjunction with many on this planet. The following pages will reveal much. At least to those who are capable of discerning knowledge, wisdom and above all, understanding. As you read through the pages, you will find yourself caught up in the story itself. Some of you will read with great delight and desire. Others will read with an utter ridicule. However, as you read, you must certainly agree that during the past 60 years, we have come a very long way in the related fields of science and technology. As you continue to read, please remember that any decision you choose is entirely up to you. Strive to maintain an open mind. The things that we think we know, we do not know at all. While the things we do not know are oft-times revealed to us surrounded by pure golden light. Thus enlarging our capability to believe. This might well be the year that UFOs will prove once and for all that we are not alone in this expanding universe and that we, members of the human family, might conceivably learn that our family ties are not restricted to this planet Earth. Remember, you are never alone. To those who have the eyes to see and the ears to hear, I say God bless you. To all others, God help you. Dr. Frank E. Strange is 1991. 22. Chapter 1 The Landing. 23. Hello, Frank, how are you? That greeting will forever be etched in my memory. It always brings me back to that cold day in December, 1959, a day which changed my life forever and one which I will recall as if it were yesterday for the rest of my life. That day began a journey which continues and one which endures even to this writing. The story began centuries ago with the first reconnaissance exploration voyage which confirmed that there indeed was life on this third planet from the sun. There had been occasions which presented a dilemma to both the observed as well as the observer. These included several pilots being beamed into the ship in order to save their lives. This was a far cry from the first incidents of men throwing rocks in an attempt to repel the ship. It was during 1945 that the Earth was surrounded by 100 ships in order to protect the fragile atmosphere which surrounds it. A chain atomic reaction could easily have resulted because of the separation of the elements of the air. Earth could have been destroyed, thus creating many problems, a ripple effect so to speak, throughout the universe. After reporting the observations of various voyages, several recommendations were made. The first was that an aerial display be performed in order to provide evidence of the physical existence of life, as it is known here, on other planets in the solar system. This was accomplished during the Truman administration over the Capitol building in Washington. DC newspapers reported the occurrence complete with details of the chase. What they didn't report was that there. 24. UFOs were not visible below the planes which had been sent up. They were only visible to those on the ground. The second recommendation was for physical contact with world leaders, beginning with the United States. The first meeting. March 16, 1957, in Alexandria, Virginia, one of the finest leaders of the planet Venus, operating under the direction of the Central Control and who had been chosen to make the contact as well as direct the project, landed his craft and was met by two police officers, weapons drawn. A thought transference quickly convinced them that he meant no harm, and he was ushered into the back seat of their patrol car. After crossing over into Washington, D.C., they were met by the Secretary of Defense along with six of his staff members. Soon police from every conceivable district and agency had joined in, all trying to claim their right to escort him to President Dwight D. Eisenhower. Through his own version of the power of positive thinking, he was able to dismiss them all and soon passed through the security posts followed by an Air Force captain. Meanwhile, his presence in the area had thrown everyone into a dilemma. The introduction he held from the High Council worried them because, though not written in any earthly language, their minds were given power to properly translate the inscribed message. Captain Gould, not his real name, asked him to remain, and after downing two plain bourbons muttered, "My God, why couldn't this have happened on my day off?" 25. 26. Val with writing tablet. 27. Suddenly the door opened and six armed guards led Val to what appeared to be an elevator. It went rapidly to the bottommost level. Maximum security was in place. After transferring to an underground train, they sped toward the White House. Six officials, six armed guards and three Secret Service men escorted him into the office of President Eisenhower. From behind the desk the president rose while the Secret Service men remained nervous and uneasy. As he extended his hand to shake that of the president, the Secret Service men drew their revolvers and pointed them at Val. Following the nod of the president, they reluctantly lowered their guns. Standing in front of his desk, the president said, "Of course, you know we have suspended all rules of protocol. I have a good feeling toward you. Please, sir, what is your name?" He replied, "Valiant." "And where do you come from?"
"I come from the planet your Bible calls the morning and the evening star. Venus?"
"Yes, sir."
"Can you prove this?" he asked.
"What do you constitute as proof?"
he quickly retorted. "I don't know."
"Will you come with me to my ship?"
he answered with a quizzical look and said, "My friend, I cannot come and go as I please. There are others to be considered. There are committees to be consulted and security measures to be adhered to. Please spend some time with us here. Let's get better acquainted. Learn more about one another. And perhaps soon, real soon, well. We shall see. Richard Nixon." At that moment, another gentleman rushed into the room. It turned out to be Vice President Richard Nixon. He appeared to Val to be very sharp, quick-witted, with fixed eyes and an amazing aptitude toward speed and proficiency.
"My name is Valiant," he said as the Vice President thrust his hand without hesitation.
"You have certainly caused a stir. For an out-of-towner." The Vice President smiled as he continued, "Of course, we are not totally convinced of anything just yet. But suffice it to say we are checking and double-checking everything you say and do. When Sergeant Young from Alexandria radioed in and stated that you had just landed in a flying saucer, we thought," he continued, "Sergeant Young had flipped. Say, were you in on the UFO flap over Washington? You certainly had us all in a dither, if you were." After assuring them that this planet had been under close scrutiny for hundreds of years before the 1945 bomb blast, and with his special letter still in the slightly quivering hand of the president, he was requested to follow the Secret Service back the way they had come. To the Pentagon and into a beautifully furnished apartment where he would spend the next 3 years. Fortunately, he was prepared for such a lengthy visit and kept in constant communication with the starship. There were many occasions during which he teleported himself in and out of those quarters, often exercising trance imagery to cause the security guards to visualize his face on a non-existent ID badge.
32. Photos taken. Soon after his arrival, together with three members of his crew, he joined a convention in the backyard of the home of Mr. Howard Menger in High Bridge, New Jersey. The month was April, 1957.
A certain group of individuals who were interested in UFOs were meeting that day. Val and his crew members, Don, Jill and Danny, had changed into the same type of clothing worn by their Earth friends. The meeting was very interesting and these people were on the right track. He was dismayed to learn the undignified manner in which these people were treated by the press. Nevertheless, these people were pursuing their beliefs and this was good. A curious young photographer, August C. Roberts, snapped several pictures, thinking he was doing so without Val's knowledge. The photographer seemed to be greatly troubled when he attempted to talk to him. Yet, it was those very photographs which were to bring me together with this unusual man on that cold December day. Holding the message from the High Council in his hand, the president stated that Val's offer to help the human family would upset the economy of the United States and could plunge her into the abyss of chaos. In brief, he politely told Val that the people of this planet were not ready to cope with such conditions as would come into existence if the recommendations of this unearthly visitor were put into action. Nevertheless, he was invited to assist a number of scientists who were out working on medical projects directly associated with the space sciences. His allotted time to acquaint the leaders of the United States with his suggestions was limited. 33. To 3 years. During this time, he refused to advise them regarding a certain bomb in the sky which we now know as the Star Wars system. Miracle Garment. In his apartment, he was able to maintain communications with his ship and was kept informed of the growing world tensions. His uniform underwent rigid tests at that time. By today's standards, they would now be obsolete. They attempted to penetrate the material with a diamond drill bit, but it snapped under pressure. Acid rolled off the uniform and burned a hole in the floor. They fired a high-velocity rifle at the uniform but it failed to pierce it. The report to the president read: Physical appearance soft silver and gold lustrous. Fabric unknown. Weight 6 ounces, total, including boots. Cut close-fitting like a tunic, no cuffs, pockets, buttons, zippers, clips or hooks. RXT-2 tests indestructible. Finally, a bright-eyed colonel escorted him to a place where the final test would be performed. Val looked at the laser instrument amusingly. Upon command, the laser aimed a fine line of intense light amplification by stimulated emission of radiation. The colonel began his discourse that this device contained a crystal synthetic ruby in which atoms, when stimulated by focused light waves, amplify and concentrate these waves, then emit the beam. As the colonel continued to speak, his smile gave way to utter dismay. The ray being totally ineffective against the garment. He babbled on. 34. Valiant Thor holding papers. 35. Long after the laser has been turned off, he reiterated how powerful the US had become since the splitting of the atom. He gave Val a lesson in atomic fusion. He went on to state that when a chain reaction of nuclear fission is set off by a neutron bombardment in the atoms or a charge of plutonium or uranium isotope with an atomic weight of 235, U-235, an immense quantity of energy is suddenly released. The good colonel finally talked himself out and Val was conducted back to his quarters along with his uniform. 1959 was fast drawing to a close. Chiefs of state were in a constant turmoil and confusion was the rule of the day. Indecision caused delay after delay. Economists and industrial giants conferred with politicians and military heads daily. The government leaders could not reconcile Val's being in a position to force their hand if he so desired. Several scientists attempted to learn the secrets of interstellar travel without success. Christmas week was now upon us. I had been busily presenting a series of scientific lectures and speaking at a number of churches in Washington, D.C. earlier that month. I had returned from Cuba where I met personally with Fidel Castro. Unbeknownst to me, Val, working with Nancy Warren, she was one of only a few since his arrival at the Pentagon in whom he was able to discern an honest and open heart and who loved Almighty God, her country and her fellow man, formulated a plan whereby I would be contacted. Inside the Pentagon. Many Earth people live one life openly while in there. 36. Hearts and minds, they live quite another.